Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. And I'm your host, Lady. When I'm not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands, startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. So first off, today at the Green Market, this morning, we'll get with Daniela Soto Ines, chef de cuisine of the 4-star New York Times hotspot Cosme, as we get into weeds, the yummy kind, that remind her of Mexico City. And then in a few minutes, live in the studio, we're going to welcome Sabato Sagaria, chief restaurant officer of the Union Square Hospitality Group. They've just opened two new spots, the Southern-inspired cocktail bar Porchlight, an untitled restaurant in the Whitney Museum. And with Sabato, we're going to talk Ohio, Jakarta, two Virginias, Aspen, and Sabato's kitchen exploits from childhood up until now. You'll want to stay to the end because to wind it down, we'll get the history of rosé through the rose-colored lens of Sabato, and we're going to get the lowdown on this month's hashtag Drink Pink with the Union Square Hospitality Group. So let's go to the Green Market first. I'm at the Union Square Green Market with Daniela Soto Ines. She is the chef de cuisine of Cosme.
Yay!
Hey, Daniela.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning. Thanks for taking a break from your fish prep to hang out with me.
I'm excited. We're here with the wild spinach. It's also lamb's quarter. We use it in Mexico City to make quesadillas, tamales, and a lot of different things. We pretty much in Cosme wait all year round for this stuff. It only lasts for a couple of months at the market, and it's called cenizo in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So we use it at different ways in Cosme.
But first, what does cenizo mean?
Cenizo, well, it has different meanings. Cenizo is, of course, lamb's quarter, but it also means an ash. So with ceniza, it's an ash. And it's pretty much, quelites is everything that is grown on the ground. So any kind of weed that is growing in the ground, we pick it up, and if it tastes delicious, we put it on a quesadilla or tamales or anything.
We put it with cheese.
We put it with cheese
or a tortilla.
With la coche, which is a corn fungus, kind of like the Mexican truffle.
Yes.
Which, unfortunately, it doesn't really grow here, but we're hoping one day it will.
Yeah. So cenizo.
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 Cenizo, yes.
Cenizo.
And that's a lamb's quarter at the market.
Yeah, wild spinach.
Yes.
And then the weed, what's that word called again?
Cenizo.
The other one.
The quelites. Quelites is weeds,
yes,
pretty much.
Quelites. So quelites. We like, weeds are delicious.
Exactly, and we have one dish at Cosme called burrata and weeds. So the burrata and weeds is extra delicious at this time of the year because we have cenizo. And we also have different dishes, like we can put, in Mexico, we put it with pork, you know, pretty much everything that is, that you will replace spinach with. Like, you saute some garlic, some onions, serranos, and you put cenizo in there, and it's just absolutely delicious.
Okay, so how does it taste different from regular spinach? I mean, it looks different. It's all like,
we're at
Windfall
like
Farms, we're at Windfall Farms right away, right by the way, which you can get this wild spinach, lamb's quarters, cenizo.
Yes, cenizo. And it's a little bit spicier than regular spinach, and it has just I feel like it has more depth to it. And it's also, I feel like it tastes more Mexican than regular spinach. So we get super excited. Also, it's like super beautiful.
Yeah, it's kind of it doesn't have the round
edges.
Yeah,
it has perfect, it's like really good fresh also. It has like perfect little leaves. And it's like also, I feel like softer than spinach.
It's like jagged edges. I don't know if it's softer than spinach. I think it's more like,
maybe
it's more weed. It definitely looks like a weed.
It looks like a weed, which I think is delicious. Like, so we have like something similar to spinach.
It just has like a buzzy, I mean, it's got like,
it's kind of like fuzzy,
buzz.
But that's dirt.
Yes.
So you have to be
okay.
Super, super careful when before you use it, because you have to wash it really, really good.
Yeah, I also have to. It's like this weird, like,
see?
Sticky stuff that's on.
Yeah, some of the things is like just natural, but the other ones, it's a lot of dirt. Like, and spinach, it usually
dirty.
Doesn't have it.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I saw some dirt in my spinach
See?
Over the weekend. Okay, yeah. So there's some stuff on it. And
yeah.
Okay, so you can have it fresh. And the burrata, are you going to combine
it? It's completely fresh.
Fresh.
We combine it with other greens at the market that are wheats.
Mm-hmm.
And we also do garlic root and salsa verde.
Okay. And then saute it up just with some garlic. Yum, yum.
Right. You can also make this into a sauce. Like the roots that you don't use or the stems that you don't use, you can use it as a cilantro stem, perhaps, or just mix it with cilantro and do raw, like a raw salsa, like tomatillos, onion, and garlic. You know, it's pretty delicious. Just put it on a blender and put some serranos.
And this is the first spring that Cosme has been open for, right? It's
when we opened late, like we opened fall, so we're super, super, we had the last of the greens of the Lamb's Quarter, and it wasn't as good. So right now we're like super, super excited to have it back.
Yeah.
And yeah, every time we look at the Lamb's Quarter at the market, we just kind of like jump.
Yes. Well, Mexican people jump.
Yeah, we jump a lot.
And then there's
sing terrible, but we love to sing.
How was Cinco de Mayo?
Oh, it was awesome.
I know Mexicans
don't really
celebrate Cinco de Mayo.
No, but you know, ever since we moved here, it's an excuse to just get extra happy and dance a lot. So it was really fun. It was really fun. We spent it with Carlo at Blanca doing tacos.
Oh, wonderful.
And we also made like a small party in Cosme, so that was fun.
Blanca, right where Heritage Radio is located.
Oh, yeah?
Right in the back of Roberta's Pizza.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So we were there just serving tacos.
So tell me about the dinner you have coming up with Tokeless Society.
Oh, my God. That's like something super, super excited. They're doing something amazing for women in the industry.
Yes, up-and-coming chefs.
Yes, and I saw the lineup of chefs, and it's like I have a huge amount of respect for them, and, you know, to be part of that is amazing. So
yeah, Tokeless Society is an organization empowering women in food, and they have a dinner coming up on...
The 8th of June. So it's a couple of weeks. Super, super.
And what dish are you cooking?
I'm doing a mushroom barbacoa with a truffle, summer truffle puree, and pickled bamboo shoots. So it
Fantastic.
Will be fun.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Okay.
It will be a lot of fun.
So head into Cosme, say hi to Daniela.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm at Leyte Su, that's L-E-I-T-I-H-S-U, on Twitter and Instagram, and also Periscope, which we're live on right now if you want to peer into the studios. At Heritage_Radio, hashtag WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW. And want to shout out to Tokeless Society. You can get your tickets for this awesome dinner at their website, Tokeless Society. That's TOKLASSociety.org. And with that, I'm so pleased to welcome people we like. Opera singer. She's amazing. She also works in restaurants. Yeah. Sabato Segaria, Chief Restaurant Officer of Union Square Hospitality Group.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
Great to be here.
So congratulations on emerging from two successful openings. Nothing terrible has happened so far.
They're both still standing, which is great. It's the first sign of success.
Porch Light and also Untitled.
Correct. Yeah, Untitled is 27 days old today, and Porch Light is 86 days old today.
And also some really exciting accolades with the happening within the group in the last month or so. A brand new MS.
Yes. So Jack Mason, our wine director at Marta, studied really hard, and he came home with a nice red pin from the Master Sommelier exam in Aspen last week. And then Mike Anthony took a trip to Chicago and won the Outstanding Chef Award from James Beard Award. So that was a huge honor for Mike, for the team at Gramercy Tavern, Untitled, and all of USHG, and really proud of all of his accomplishments and the accomplishments of those teams.
And fantastic for hiring. A lot of good buzz.
We hope so. We hope so. Mm-hmm.
So what are you, I mean, I know you're always hiring, but what are you hiring the most intensely for right now?
I think it's just always looking for great people that want to join the organization and grow and learn about what we do. And with 12 restaurants, it's really neat to be able to provide people with a lot of different outlets or learn a lot about what drives them and what the, it's very important to find the right match for the right business, the right mentor, the right teacher. And so in doing so, can learn all about pasta, about pizza, about Southern food, about vegetables. I mean, there's so many different options. And so, you know, looking for great front of house folks, great back of house talent as well. So, and it's really exciting to meet the people from all different backgrounds coming in to you know, with hopes of joining the organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have this very unusual title, which is Chief Restaurant Officer. I mean, come on, it's pretty funny.
It's
really funny.
It's a unique title.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone, I've never met another, kind of like how Eric Asimov is the only, like, wine critic, like, full-time wine critic out of major publication.
I haven't met another CRO yet.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean there's not one out there. But I've been on CRO Mingle, and I haven't seen one or met one.
It's usually
so.
Yourself with a cocktail.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
At home.
Yeah, exactly. But no, it's a unique title and a unique job that I feel very fortunate to have. Basically, in my role, I help support all of our chefs and GMs, and that's different from a restaurant that's 30 years old, like Union Square Cafe, to a restaurant that's 27 days old, like Untitled. And so being able to support those leaders and their businesses and allow them to hopefully do their job even better and more effortless, and that's what I get to do and provide connective tissue between all of our restaurants and cross-promote best practices and the, you know, migration of talent through the restaurants.
So it sounds like you do kind of way more in a way more restaurant pro way, but you're like what I understand a communicator and a connector within the organization, so you're having conversations all the time.
Exactly. So looking across the whole landscape of our company, trying to understand what drives people, what their aspirations are, and how we can connect those dots and help them get there along the way.
Where did you grow up?
Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
Part of it all. Yes. Yeah, Columbus, Ohio, for most of my, I was born in State College, Pennsylvania, but grew up in Columbus, Ohio, went to high school there, and I spent a year in Jakarta, Indonesia, which was really interesting and inspiring.
Eye-opening for you.
Tremendously. You know, as a, I think I was 13 at the time, my parents probably thought I was going to run away when they told me we were moving to Jakarta, but I sort of dug my heels in, didn't want to do it, but now that I look back on it, it was such a pivotal time in terms of who I am as a person, and I really opened my eyes to.
So for a kid, what is that like? You know, is it like, what the heck? We're moving to this country that like it's like on a map, and
yeah, it was
all my friends are here. I don't know.
I was pouting, you know, crossing my arms, stomping my feet, doing all that, and once I got there, I realized, hey, I'm here, I'm in it. Let's make the most of it, and so that was. Learning the language.
Do you speak something?
Saya bisa bicara bahasa Indonesia.
Whoa, yeah. That's Indonesian.
Indonesian, yeah.
Pardon my, yes, Indonesian.
I speak a little Indonesian.
That's really impressive.
Yeah, so not that it comes in handy that often,
yep.
But I could probably hold my own in an Indonesian restaurant and order you dinner. So that's the important stuff.
That's totally the important stuff.
Yeah.
Well, this experience in Jakarta was what led you to decide
on hospitality as your career, right?
Yes. So I lived in Jakarta, and my parents lived around about 3 hours away in Bandung. Mm-hmm. And I would go visit them once a month. And they had a friend who was the GM of the local five-star hotel, and he invited me to spend a day with him. And I was touring the hotel and, you know, enamored with the pastry shop, and they were making chocolates, the rooftop swimming pool overlooking the mountains, and then, you know, being homesick, you know, those cravings of food that reminds you of home are so powerful. And so I remember sitting down to lunch, and I got to order whatever I wanted, and there I was, you know, halfway around the world eating a cheeseburger with French fries, Heinz tomato ketchup, and an orange Fanta. And I was like, so comforting and so far from home, but yet so connected to home. And I thought that was such a neat feeling and sensation. It said, hey, I'd love to be in an environment that can do this for others. And so that's what sort of put me on the route, say, hey, I want to go to study hotel restaurant management and then see what comes of that.
Was the cheeseburger actually on the menu, or did you just sort of make up a Sultan's lunch?
No, it was on the menu.
Okay.
So I wasn't being a diva and ordering off the menu.
Yes.
But it was one that was on there, and wasn't the best cheeseburger in the world, but it struck a chord with me for the kid that hadn't had a cheeseburger in a couple months.
You were discerning as a young kid as well, it sounds like.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so very early on, you learned of the power of food to make people happy. Mm-hmm. And tell me about that one time that you banished your parents to upstairs and then you cooked, you know, dinner for your date.
So this was after coming back from Indonesia. And I, being from an Italian family, my aunts would love to cook around the holidays. And it was just part of the family. And I never really got to cook too much with them, but I got to see and pick up on their little techniques and stuff. So I had a girl that I was on the cusp of dating, I guess, and in high school, and
you were wooing.
I was trying to wow her. Yes. So her parents dropped her off at my house at around 5:30 one evening, and I banished my parents upstairs to the second floor, and I'd been slaving all day making spaghetti, meatballs, and tomato sauce, and I wowed her, and you know, she was giving me so much credit and praise for how delicious these meatballs were and everything.
Wow.
I did from scratch. And she loved the dessert, the strawberry cheesecake I made for her. And then she goes to help clean and scrape the dishes. And she saw the Jell-O cheesecake box in the trash can. And my cover was blown. Like, she thought that I was a fraud and, you know, it was Prego and store-bought meatballs. And I had to talk her off the ledge and say, no, everything I made from scratch except the cheesecake, but I did make it from a box, and so it wasn't just store-bought. So I guess I talked my way out of that. I got a kiss at the end of the night. Mm-hmm. When her parents came to pick her up, and I think that sort of clued me into, I said, I better learn how to cook. And that's what one of the things, contributing factors to why I like to cook.
Did you end up becoming boyfriend-girlfriend?
We did. She
oh,
checked
wow.
that box, yes, and we dated happily ever after through our junior year.
Excellent.
Yes.
And you had some pretty creative dishes. Like, this guy, like, you know, we don't get to see him in the kitchen as much these days, but he was kind of a beast in the kitchen as a kid. Tell me about some of these dishes.
Sure. I was a culinary hack, I guess, back in the day. And this was before my spaghetti meatball days. One of my sort of closet cravings when I'd come home from school and my parents were teaching and I'd be there by myself, I'd make crouton salads. So I would take store-bought croutons and I'd put blue cheese dressing on them and just eat them, or blue cheese soup with croutons, depending on the ratio that we put in there. That was one of my favorites. And then I also had the Asian dip is what I called it. And I would make ramen noodles. I would take a loaf of French bread or baguette.
So, but are we talking Maruchan? Like, what was, like, the brand?
This was just a 25-cent ramen noodles, whatever
they
were.
Yeah, is it, like, in a cup or in a baggie?
Oh, it was a baggie.
Okay.
The baggie, yeah. And then I would break a baguette in half. I'd hollow it out, cook the ramen noodles, take them out, toss them in butter. I would then take the noodles and put them inside the baguette, and I would then have the broth on the side and would dip it in there. So it was carbo-loading at an early age for my dinners that I was cooking for myself.
And your parents, like, knew, they were, like, cool with that?
Yeah, I don't know if it was actually sanctioned by them, but I think they were just happy to see me actually cooking.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you decided to go into food, you know, were they surprised? Were they happy for you?
I think they were happy for me to find something that I connected to and that I was passionate about.
Yeah.
And they were very supportive of wanting me to do that to the best of my abilities and help me make the decisions along the way. And should I go work here or here? And understanding who my mentors would be along the way, and that I was always aspiring, and they were supportive of me in getting there.
So there was one point in your life when you considered going to business school.
Yes, I had been, I had worked at the Greenbrier in West Virginia for 7 years and then went to the Inn at Little Washington where I was the wine director. And after 9 years in the two Virginias, I was at a loss as to what to do next and wanted to sort of take a time out from the hospitality world and thought that going to business school might be a great solution for that and allow me to look at it through a different perspective. Applied to 5 schools. I didn't get into any. And then Aspen came calling, and I took a job as the food and beverage director at the Little Nell in Aspen. And I think that was a very fortunate timing that I didn't get into business school, because that's when I would have been graduating, was when the economy was at a downturn and would have been very challenging for me to get a job, and probably would have been back in restaurants anyway. So
yeah. So this is this would have been, yeah, with a lot more debt.
Yeah.
This is around the early 2000s.
08, 09.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that one. Okay.
Yeah, that one. Mm-hmm.
Sheesh. Huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. So these days you're also active in the kitchen about once a week.
Yes.
Got your Casa de Sab, hashtag Sunday Suppers. Check out his Instagram. He's at Sabato3. Mm-hmm. What's up with the three?
I'm the third. So there's three other Sabato,
oh, really?
Two other Sabatos out there, but that's how one
Sabato
two,
means
Saturday.
Saturday.
My middle name is Domenico, which is Sunday. Mm-hmm. So Saturday, Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking for whatever my handle was, and Sabato 1 was taken, Sabato 2 was taken, Sabato 3 was not, and coincidentally, I am the third, so it just worked.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Sunday suppers.
Sunday suppers. I've always enjoyed cooking. You know, I got my start as one of my first jobs was at the Greenbrier Hotel cooking in the kitchens, and always enjoyed that aspect. And even at the Greenbrier on days off, have a bunch of friends that were chefs over, and we'd cook dinner together and break bread, and really like the communal aspect of it. So
mm-hmm.
Wherever I've lived, I've enjoyed throwing dinner parties and doing that. And moving to New York, I didn't have enough time to cook as much as I would like, as most people probably in New York. And so from day one...
Do you actually have a pretty cookable kitchen?
I've cooked in smaller kitchens. I've cooked in bigger kitchens.
Okay.
It's by no means a dream kitchen, but it's functional.
Okay.
So I just try and use Sundays as a chance for me to recharge, get ready for the week, slow down a bit, and, you know, do some cooking at home. It's, to me, it's like that scene in Goodfellas when they're in jail cooking and they're slicing the garlic with the razor blades. It seems so civilized. And while I don't slice garlic with razor blades, that's how it, you know, just kind of a nice chill evening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so are you cooking for yourself? Are you cooking for family, friends, la-di-da?
La-di-da, mostly.
Yeah.
cooking for, it depends on what's going on in my world, other people's worlds.
Yeah.
Could be as large as 7-8 people, could be just for myself. But it really depends on what's going on. And but whether it's for a lot of people or just myself, it's just a fun chance to try new recipes, find inspiration from our chefs in our restaurants, walking through the Green Market on the way to the work.
Yep.
What I see in a magazine or a cookbook or a dish in a restaurant. So
it's a pretty fun way to see all of your creativity, just kind of clicking on that hashtag. What's been some of your favorite dishes?
Oh, some of my favorite dishes. I had a trip to Southeast Asia, went to Thailand and Japan, and that really inspired me with some other chef friends. And so a lot of Thai dishes, pho in a crock pot is one of my favorites during the winter
time.
Oh
my gosh, that sounds awesome.
That's amazing. Paella.
Yeah.
Which is a fun one for groups, yakitori. I love making pizza, although when I make pizza in my New York apartment compared to some of my other places, all my neighbors know that I'm making pizza because the fire alarm goes off. So I don't make it with as much frequency as I have in the past, but that's one of my kind of comfort, craveable sort of dishes that I like to make.
And Aspen was a lucky silver lining on the cloud of not making it into business school. And it's such this unique place in the world where people go and then they emerge master sommeliers. Ta-da!
It's in the water there, yeah.
Yeah, what's up with Aspen? Like, what is it like?
Aspen is a pretty magical place, and I think most people go there, like, after school and just say, hey, I'm going to press pause on life. I guess I went there because I didn't get into business school. And it's a pretty magical place in the sense that in Colorado, people are very outdoorsy, very competitive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're training for a marathon, or if you're learning to ski or mountain bike or road bike, you like to do so with someone that's better than you and that pushes you. Someone usually introduces you to a sport, and with that you know get that fire and say, I want to be better.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Aspen that carries over into the wine world, and there have been some great folks that I view as mentors and peers that came before me in Aspen who did that for myself and others. And, you know, Jay Fletcher is probably the father figure there. Bobby Stuckey, Richard Betts.
Now, tell me more about Jay Fletcher, because yeah. I know Bobby and Richard.
Sure.
And there's just this whole parade of MSs. And then did Dustin also?
Dustin came through there.
So Dustin Wilson at 11 Madison Park,
yep.
A bald MS.
Yep.
And then
he was
also
the fourth bald master sommelier.
Carlton McCoy, who
yep.
is the current wine
director. Yep. Sixth bald master
Nell.
Sommelier.
Uh-huh. Sixth.
He's the sixth.
Really? So it's not even just three?
Dustin's fourth bald master
okay.
sommelier. I'm the fifth, and then Carlton's the sixth.
So the test makes you lose all of your hair.
Well, I think we all shaved it ahead of time, so we wouldn't have to waste our time doing our hair every morning. We could focus that energy on and time on studying.
And
so
it
that's
never
how
grew
I
up. It never grew back.
Too much of a good thing. It's a good luck charm. I, you know, got to hold on to it.
So, so tell me about Jay Fletcher.
So when I was, I passed the advance prior to mm-hmm. moving to Aspen, and in doing so, I was living in Virginia and West Virginia, and there really wasn't a community of wine lovers to study with. So I was studying by myself, and so I wasn't in a part of a community. Going to Aspen, I saw the community that Jay had created.
Yeah, and who is he?
So he is works for Southern Wine and Spirits.
Okay,
he passed his MS exam, I want to say in the early 90s,
mm-hmm.
But a great story and just humble beginnings and. Viewed wine as an out. He was a pool shark, a hustler, and
wow, really?
In the restaurant business helped him find who he was. And he had some key people that helped him get there. And when he passed his exam, he started doing the same for others. And people that came through Aspen that wanted to make a career out of the restaurant business, Jay helped them understand wine and helped coach them and cheer them on as they went through that process. And so he did so with Bobby, with Richard, and in doing so, helped create a great community of sommeliers in Aspen. So when I moved to Aspen, I saw that community and said, mm-hmm. you know what? I wasn't going to continue on my MS journey, but because I could now be part of a community, it had a whole different intrigue for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to
belong,
connect, have someone push me, help contribute to other people's success and teach along the way was really inspiring and said, hey, I'm here. I have a great support structure.
So this Jay is really the guy who's kind of the godfather of the Aspen
all Colorado in general. And then mm-hmm. even beyond that, people, he's a great taster. And that was my last hurdle that I had to overcome was tasting.
Really?
And a lot of people fly from wherever in the country to go taste with Jay and sit at his kitchen table. He's like Yoda, kind of.
Oh, my God. That's really amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure then Jay Fletcher and his kitchen table were a big part of the Somme movie.
There's no video in Jay's kitchen.
Oh, really?
No, they didn't film anything in
that's so exciting.
What happens in Jay's kitchen stays in Jay's kitchen.
Really? So there's no, but he doesn't.
We've never, he's never been asked to do that, or we've never done that.
Okay.
But,
I'm like, that is such a cool, like, little niche.
But,
situation.
Yeah, but you know, to get to become a good taster, there's a lot of bad tastings that happen, and Jay is great with giving feedback, and that's very important through the whole process, is taking feedback and applying it and bettering oneself, because the road to the success in the MS program is also paved with a lot of potholes along the way, and how you get through those and how you overcome that those setbacks, whether it's not passing a part or not passing an exam. Usually if you can channel that and make yourself stronger through the process, it better prepares you for the next chapter.
And the MS exam is about a jillion times harder than the GMAT, so
it's much more fun to study for than the GMAT.
Congratulate you. You know when you turn something like wine or food into something that you have to be like super intense about? It's funny. It's like you have to really love it to...
You do. I mean, you're going to spend that much time focused on a subject. You better love it. If not, I think you're only going to be able to get so far in it. And it's one of those great things where it's... fortunately, the whole restaurant business is one that I love, and that way it doesn't feel like work, and I can take my work home with me.
Yeah.
And it's just fun.
So did you become like a... Did you stay sane with like your life and your relationships with friends and family during the process? I mean,
it's all in perspective, I think, when you talk about sanity.
Okay.
During that time, it's definitely really trying, and there were some casualties of that. I think
casualties
just in relationships and along the way with girlfriends who took a side seat to that studying process. Mm-hmm. And it's all consuming, and you almost get to the mindset saying that if I don't spend this hour today studying, I'm never going to get that back. And when you're sitting there at that final exam, and the last thing you want to do is come up an hour short from your studying. And so it was all consuming in that.
Yeah.
But I did realize through some of the setbacks I had through the ways that I needed to also have balance in my life. And so that was the turning point for me, was to really understand how I could get centered but also stay focused. And Aspen was an amazing place for that, whether that was going for a 2-hour bike ride just to clear my mind and then be able to go study, snowboarding, hiking, you know, whatever that may be. Just really appreciating my surroundings forced me to put my flashcards down and focus on myself, and then focus on studying for the exam.
So you and Carlton are good friends. Mm-hmm. Who's the better skier?
I snowboard, he skis.
Okay.
In the short amount of time that Carlton has skied, he's probably had more injuries than I have.
He came on my show last year and talked about having an injury every year, which sounds pretty gnarly.
Exactly. I think I might try another sport, perhaps, if I were Carlton.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good way
to put
it.
Curling might be a good winter sport that's a little safer, something along those lines.
You know, you talk about the movie Som, and you appeared in Som. Mm-hmm. It helped your parents understand just how academically rigorous the test is.
Yeah, it was really neat. Both of my parents are professors.
Yeah.
And
what do they teach?
So my mom teaches higher education. So
she teaches teachers how to teach.
Exactly.
That's in a very, very elegant way.
Yeah. So people that want to run universities and schools and things like that. Mm-hmm. My dad teaches psychology and statistics. So growing up, they always wanted me to go to, you know, business school, graduate school, whatever that may be, to further my learning and keep my options open. So when I told them I was studying for wine, they didn't quite understand what that meant. You know, growing up, we weren't around.
My mom doesn't, too.
Yeah.
She thinks, she's like, so on Facebook, you drink a lot? And I'm like, but mom, it's my job. I'm tasting.
You can rationalize anything these days, can't you? So for them to see that, it was really stressful and very pivotal time in my career, a very impactful time. So for them to see what we went through, the community that helped me achieve that goal, and what it meant to my peers in my industry, really was pretty special for me to be able to have that memorialized, even in just a small portion of the movie, but to see the whole context of what that is.
And you played golf as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into that?
My grandfather, avid golfer, and so I'd go into Florida and we'd hit golf balls on the beach, and I just enjoyed doing that. And it was one of my hobbies that, again, growing up allowed me to stay focused and keep balance.
I think just talk to people who of all different stripes, shapes, colors, sizes, people a lot older than a little kid.
And so I grew up in Columbus, and my mom was a professor at Ohio State, so I used to play golf at Ohio State. Not for Ohio State, but at Ohio State on the campus. And so as a little, 12-year-old or 15-year-old, going out and spending 4.5 hours with three complete strangers and having conversations with them and all different walks of life, as you mentioned, different backgrounds, just really looking at how life is through different people's perspectives and how to connect with them. And I'm sure my dad's psychology teachings and rubbed off on me, and I think that probably led to my love of the restaurant business and interacting with your team, finding ways to connect with your guests, and understanding what drives people or what brings happiness to them.
You know, besides a failure to get into business school, which, by the way, makes your path even more, sort of laser focused, kind of illustriously resume impressive. Uh-huh. I'm just going to put a lot of words into because I'm like, whoa. Like, we're not going to go through it all, one by one.
Right.
We're not going to do that. But yes, very impressive. Okay. With that, is there a realization, about the business of hospitality or the business of life that it took you, maybe you thought A first and then you realized B?
I think one thing for me was looking at it, I was very focusing, I want to do this or do that. And I tried to diversify my experiences along the way. And in doing so, I was able to find mentors or people that I could connect with in different aspects, whether that's the kitchen, whether that's the business side of things, the wine side of things, the beverage side of things. That was always very instrumental in me understanding what my next step was and how I should diversify my background to not necessarily narrow my options, but to expand my options moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a way that I think afforded me the opportunity to know how to have a conversation with a CFO as we're talking through a P&L. If it's talking with a chef that's trying to look for a better understanding of their food costs, or deal with a sommelier who's looking to flesh out a wine list, all those different things that are so much a part of what the restaurant business is.
Yeah, I find that, at least in non-restaurant businesses, being more versatile these days is important.
Mm-hmm. And it's fun for me. It keeps it interesting and much more diverse. And coming up in my career, I started out working at hotels, and I enjoyed that because there were so many different outlets, probably 3 or 4 restaurants under one roof. There was room service, there were banquets, and different folks coming in and utilizing the hotel for different purposes. And so that was always really exciting. And so now being able to work in a company, an organization that has, 12 restaurants that everything from, southern food to pizza to fine dining to cocktails.
So we have a new cocktail bar. Our hotel's in the future for the Unisquare Hospitality Group.
One thing at a time.
We
one
have
thing
the
at
right
time.
Guy to do it.
But that's just the fun, that diversity, and also being able to find inspiration in each one of those and cross over into something, another thing that might be just on the peripheral, but being able to take inspiration from it, whether that's another business, or another industry or another, culture. It's always fun.
Well, so is there something that you now have learned that maybe you didn't know starting out, because we can acquire the skills and know-how and empathy in all the different areas of business, but maybe there's something that maybe you learned this year by stretching.
By stretching.
Yeah.
For me, I think I've learned and appreciated, kind of gotten more clarity about the importance of teaching.
Okay.
Being both my parents are professors, and teaching folks and seeing how they gave back, learning how I've been able to give back just as people helped me get to a certain point in my career. It's very rewarding to help others do that as well. And by going through the wine, use that as an example. Mm-hmm. Teaching wine was a way that I could learn more about a topic learn how to digest that topic, and then help share it with my team, growing them and growing me through that process. So it was really neat to see that. And there's nothing more gratifying than being able to light a spark in somebody's eye and say, wow, I could do this for a living, whether that's cooking, whether that's being a server, a sommelier, a bartender, and realize, wow, this is a career, and you can have a passion, and you can really strive and aspire for more. That's very rewarding and such a key part of what drives me every day.
Two last questions for you. How did you and Danny meet and then get to this whole chief restaurant officer business? And then who came up with that name? Was it you or him or someone else?
That was Danny, you know, thinking outside the box and coming up with a...
Because CEO is so boring.
Exactly. So 2014, 13. So I had met, you know, another fortuitous meeting. Danny would always stay with us in Aspen at the Little Nell when he came up for Aspen Food and Wine. So got to know him through mutual acquaintances. And then I was at the Pebble Beach Food and Wine Festival. And
then the day before, your girlfriend at the time was like, I want to move to New York. And you're like... The only place I would move to New York for is
was to work with Danny. Exactly. And so that was one of those things where we were just like, whoa, that happened the day before. And then chatting with Danny the next day over a cup of coffee.
So he literally was like, I have this role open. And
we're thinking about creating this position. And, you know, is that something that would excite you, that you might see a fit? Would you ever consider doing something like that? So we started... talking, and over the next 3 months, a couple trips to New York and conversations and getting to meet people in the team, really got to understand where the company was, who the people were that bring it to life every day, and understanding what and how I could help contribute to them, and we could work together.
Just super duper super duper flattering.
Yes.
And amazing.
Very much
and
so.
I'm very excited for you and the company. And my last question for you before we wind it down after the brief commercial break is your dream job. If you weren't already doing your dream job, whoops, I know it's really hard to ask food people this.
Yeah. I love my job now. So
you don't have to say that. Okay. You know that.
I like the creative aspect of marketing and it would be great if it could also be in restaurants. That would be one thing. Also love golf and travel. So if it could be some combination of golf, travel, and food, and
golf,
leading tours.
Golf and travel and food and marketing.
Yeah, some combination.
Yeah. We'll take out food because you weren't supposed to do food. So golf, travel, and marketing.
Okay, but can I eat food while we travel and play golf?
Okay, you can still eat, but take that part out because you're already... Okay.
Yes.
Very cool.
Yeah.
With just a little bit of time left to wind it down in a couple minutes after this brief commercial break, we'll talk a couple of rosé fun facts and the world and history according to Sabato Sagaria, MS.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth on Heritage Radio Network. And today to wind it down.
Wind down.
We have Sabato Sagaria, Chief Restaurant Officer of the Union Square Hospitality Group, still here with us in the studios. And we're going to talk rosé because this is the month of hashtag drink pink.
Yes.
Yes.
It's the second year we've done this, and it's a really neat program we do with all of our restaurants where we highlight rosé, kicking off the month of May to help help give people a reason to come outside and drink and celebrate after a long, cold winter. And at each of our restaurants, they have a wine point of view, and it's a chance for them to all express their wine point of view through rosé. And it's all for a good cause. So we donate $1 from every glass sold to the Bed-Stuy Campaign Against Hunger. And that's always great when you can drink a glass of wine for a good cause.
Fantabulous. And rosé. Now, real men drink rosé, and real men wear pink socks.
Yep, I guess that makes me a real man.
And then also wear champagne bottle cufflinks. Yep. And wear pink shirts that match.
That is I.
We're just painting the picture of Salvatore right now. So for folks who haven't, you know, studied intensely the history of rosé, like, What is the history of rosé?
I think for most Americans, they probably their history of rosé starts maybe with Matus or Lancers in the 70s, 80s, just sort of cheap swill at that point. And then it really took off probably in the 70s with Sutter Homes, when Bob Trinchero stumbled across a lot that wouldn't ferment completely and had an off-dry pink wine. And that's what really most people associate with rosé, probably for about 25, 30 years in the U.S. And I even remember it was probably 2003, 2004. I was at the end of Little Washington, and I was the wine director there, and still saying, I need to put a white Zinfandel on the list for those people that want to drink white Zinfandel. And said, but I don't want to put white Zin, so let's try something from the south of France. I forget which wine it was, but it was slightly off dry. And then Riesling took the place of that. And then now I can't really remember the last time I saw a wine list with white Zinfandel on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how about before that, though? Rosé started in Provence.
Provence is, you know, where I don't know historically if that's exactly where it started, but I know that's the one where most wine lovers really tribute to the boom of rosé. And in France, they consume more rosé than they do white wine. And that's been really neat.
Really?
Also to see that with our new restaurant, Studio Cafe, up on the 8th floor at the Whitney. As we look at the first month that we've been open, we've sold more rosé than we have white or red wine.
You just can't go wrong with rosé.
It's just one of those, to me, it's like a corona of wine, in the sense where it changes your whole latitude and attitude. And you don't get too intellectual over rosé. It's just a nice way to celebrate life through that glass of rosé.
And it means a lot more coming from a master sommelier. Because he said we can relax, so we're all relaxing.
Exactly. Relax with friends on a patio, and it's like sunshine in glass.
So you recently did a piece in Town and Country with our friend and colleague Sam Dagermond, all about fun facts that you didn't know about rosé. Mm-hmm. So apparently rosé dates back to 2,600 years ago. Mm-hmm. Which is like, what were we doing back then?
What vintage was that? That was,
I know. I was like, I can't even understand. Okay.
I wouldn't recommend trying rosé from that initial vintage. Probably not so bueno.
Let's dig it up. And then also, you know, I think sometimes people look at rosé and they're like, well, can I just make this by blending red and white wine? And like, in fact, you can, but only in France.
In some places in the world you can. In France, it's illegal to blend.
Oh, illegal. You cannot.
Illegal. It is not. Okay. You will go to jail. If you blend white wine and red wine, the only exception is in Champagne, where they're allowed to do that blending to get rosés.
All over the world, as with, you know, rules in wine in general, you can do whatever the hell you want. In France, there are rules. You can only blend red and white wine to make rosé champagne.
Correct.
Okay. That is very, I'm about to like just ace the
You're
rosé
ready to pass
part
the
of
test,
the
yes.
test. Yes. And then the term for, okay. So we have, so explain the three ways that we can make rosé.
So we talked about the blending of it. And then there is with minimal skin contact, that's one way. Mm-hmm. And then also just the bleeding off of free run juice when they're pressing the grapes and having that come off. And that's the most common way, the Saunier method.
Okay, and it's a Provençal rosé is made from which way?
The Saunier
method. Okay, mm-hmm. And then finally, the Hamptons landed in the news last year for running out of rosé. And that was like a big deal because the Hamptons...
what would the Hamptons be without rosé summertime? So that was a big controversy that I forget which newspaper was publishing, that there was a chance that there would be a rosé shortage in the Hamptons. And so people were going to their wine shops and clearing off the shelves just like they would milk or water in the case of a storm. So, but contrary to popular belief, the Hamptons did not run out of rosé last year.
You know this because you're the...
Because I did not drink rosé in the Hamptons, but I saw many Instagram posts of people drinking rosé in the Hamptons.
Okay, so I'm going to look more into that because that really piqued my interest.
Exactly. Like, you should report from the scene this summer, and you can track every week how the supply of rosé is doing in the Hamptons.
This is Lacey reporting live from the Hamptons.
And instead of a microphone, you'll have a glass of rosé in your hand.
Amazing. So hashtag drink pink.
Yes.
Everyone go hashtag drink pink. There's still a couple days left.
Yes, but even after the official drink pink season is over in May, we will still be serving rosé up for people all across the city throughout the entire summer and beyond, because rosé is not just for summertime.
Thank you so much, Sabato.
Thank you, lady.
And we're live 2 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyti, and that was just Sabato Segaria, the chief restaurant officer of the Union Square Hospitality Group. Thanks so much for listening. Go check out their 12 different spots now. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.